Welcome to the Big Unlock Podcast, your leading source for insights and best practices on the digital transformation of healthcare. Join host Patty Padmanabhan, CEO of Damo Consulting and best-selling author of Healthcare Digital Transformation, How Consumerism, Technology, and Pandemic Are Accelerating the Future, in conversation with healthcare and technology leaders. This podcast is brought to you with the support of our partners, Innovacer and Palvox.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back. This is Patty, and it is my great privilege and honor to introduce my special guest today, Matthew Roman, Chief Digital Officer at Duke Health. Matt, what a pleasure to have you on our show, and welcome.
Hey, good afternoon, Patty. Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you.
You're most welcome. So why don't we get started with maybe a little bit of an overview of Duke Health, the populations that you serve, and your role in the organization.
Yeah, thank you. I have the pleasure of serving as the Chief Digital Strategy Officer for Duke University Health System. It is a medium-sized but very high-quality academic medical center. We're pretty proud of the quality of care we offer here. We have three hospitals in our system. We're located in the center of North Carolina. So we have a flagship academic hospital, and two community hospitals, and then a large series of clinics, both primary care and a large specialty faculty practice as well. I report into the Chief Information Officer, and we support the academic mission through the schools of medicine and nursing, as well as the health system functions.
So the mission includes the education side of it, the research side of it, and also the healthcare delivery organization, which is kind of typical for any AMC. I guess.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay, so in your role as Chief Digital Strategy Officer, maybe you could give us a little bit of an overview of the digital programs that are currently in flight at Duke Health. Maybe touch upon one or two things, like telehealth, for instance, which has been a big growth area for most organizations. So maybe you could give us an overview, Matt.
Sure, sure. Our Digital Strategy Office was formed about 3.5 years ago. It's the vision of our Chief Information Officer, who's a physician himself. And so we are responsible for consumer-friendly, patient-facing technologies to help with our patients' attempts to engage with us as a health system. We're taking an approach where we're deep in the throes of implementing a number of what I would call foundational technology platforms, on which over the next couple of years, we'll build hopefully more and more and more, more effective and broader reaching use cases. So these platforms include some of which are fully embedded already, some of which are in flight. As you mentioned, Patty, our telehealth platform, which everybody in the country has to have now. We're responsible for our patient portal and are doing some things around the patient portal to improve our experience of the patients. A CRM strategy, a strategy around conversational AI and chatbot, a strategy where we reach out to the patients to learn from them what they want from us. We're doing this through a virtualized patient advisory council. Some others have done this as well too. And remote patient monitoring, both in support of the telehealth platform, the visits of today that are conducted virtually, but also in support of continuing care, even if that care is delivered in person. We're able to then, through these remote patient monitoring strategies, capture data points in much greater frequency to support clinical decision-making and predictive modeling and such.
Yeah, those are clearly the top foundational platforms for a lot of health systems. And we'll unpack all of that. Let's start with telehealth. What have been the volumes? And I know everyone had a spike during the pandemic, but that's also dropping off a little bit and maybe reaching some level of equilibrium. And obviously the questions around how patients are responding to it, and of course, how caregivers are responding to it as well, from the point of view of training, workflows and so on. Talk to us a little bit about what that experience has been like, and feel free to, talk about any platforms that you've used to execute on it and your whole strategy. Are you using one? Are you using multiple platforms for different things? How do they all fit with your other tools that you talked about, especially the EHR platform, but also other tools that are involved in delivering the seamless experience for patients?
Yeah, sure. So we had an experience like most others. We had a pretty small telehealth footprint. We had some early adopters pre-pandemic, some really impressive work, though, pre-pandemic. For instance, our movement disorder clinic has a neurologist that was a very early adopter of telehealth. His patients are ALS patients who have tremendous movement and mobility disorders, and it takes an army to bring them to our clinic. And he has a pretty wide capture rate or capture geography. And so we were able to work with him to enable video visits of these patients. It was a tremendous satisfier. Very white glove, very high touch at the time on our side. Of course, we had the same hockey stick increase in volume as everybody else did in March of last year. We went from, no kidding now, we went from 100 visits a month to 2,000 visits a day, much like everybody else. I've seen from colleagues around the country in the last couple of months, have seen these numbers tail. The truth is our highest month volume since the start of the pandemic was March of 2021. And then since March, we've started to tail off just a little bit. We continue to have pretty high volume in some specialties. Our behavioral health and psychiatry clinics have remained very high adopters of, high utilizers of. Our primary care clinics are continuing to be strong here. Certainly some of the specialty and surgery clinics as well. We have a primary platform that's embedded in our electronic health record, and we have a backup platform too. So we are able to capture if, in fact, a patient doesn't have an app on their device or has some connectivity issues, then we can rescue or salvage that by sending a rescue link. And so we have two active platforms that we're working with currently.
You also mentioned chatbots. So have you been using them more in the context of clinical chats or more in an administrative context, let's say, for enabling access and providing patients with information and self-service tools, or are you doing both?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're in the very relatively early stages of implementing our chatbot, and we're cutting our teeth on administrative functions. We will tread lightly in offering clinical advice through artificial intelligence, just more from a risk tolerance and quality assurance perspective than anything else, I think. But we're starting from an administrative place. To your point, access, some instructions, directions, wayfinding, touchless arrival, these sorts of things, and then we'll branch from there.
Is the approach to maybe start small, establish adoption levels, and make sure that the chats work effectively and people feel comfortable with it before you start going to more complex and maybe more high stakes, high risk kind of functions? Is that the approach?
Well, that's right. And we're also working very hard with these, the secret sauce about these platforms is not the platform themselves, but making certain that we know, for instance, if the patient has a remote monitoring device in their home, we're monitoring their blood pressure via home checks, and then they engage with us via chatbot, that our chatbot response is informed by the fact that they actually are a remote monitored patient, and we can get smart to our answer. And we would answer that patient differently via artificial intelligence, knowing that they had an RPM device, than if we knew that that patient didn't. And so it's this connection between these platforms that's really so intriguing to me.
Yeah. Let's talk about CRM. You mentioned that, and you and I have spoken before on this. Where are you in your CRM journey? It seems to be, when I look across the landscape, people are in different stages of deploying enterprise-class CRM platform and really using that to transform their patient experiences. Could you talk a little bit about where you are in the journey and what are some of your focus areas with the CRM platform?
We've implemented an enterprise-level CRM in our Duke Health marketing shop. So that was our first stretch into the CRM, and it was a number of years ago. And since then, we have an outfit here called the Duke Clinical Research Organization. It's a large CRO. So they have an installation of the same CRM tool that helps them manage trials. They manage multi-center trials, not just site-based research. And they do a bunch of work in the CRM, in that DCRI unit too. And now we're in the 11th hour of our implementation of the CRM tool in our Access Services Center. And so we have an Access Services Center that has multiple hubs that basically serves all of our primary and specialty care providers. They take 2 to almost 3 million calls a year and schedule 1 to 2 million appointments a year out of that Access Service Center. And so you do that math real quickly, it's almost 2 calls per appointment. And so what we're hoping to do is be able to get a little bit smarter in our engagement, knowing who the patients are, knowing who's calling, and knowing the call history, which right now we don't have much insight into, which we'll be able to with the CRM. And I can envision very, very easily patient acquisition efforts from the marketing effort, marketing shop with the CRM tool, and helping to create journeys from when we acquire a patient very first to when we actually schedule that patient for a desired or needed or requested services, to then linking them to the portal and other things that we have downstream so that we can consistently engage with our patients, know about them, know about every encounter we've had with them clinically and administratively to reduce friction and lower the barrier for entry.
Have you started seeing results from this implementation, especially in the contact center operations?
Yeah, the honest truth is our contact center will go live in August. So we're deep in the implementation phase. Let's talk in a year and I'll hopefully have great stories for you.
Well, all the best too with that Kula. I know how those things go. So I just want to touch on the last foundational platform that you mentioned, which is remote monitoring. And again, you mentioned that in the context of a chronic disease. And you know, that's where most of the deployments have been from an RPM standpoint. How has it worked so far, especially the aspects where you bring back the data from the devices and the sensors and so on, and you're trying to combine that with patient longitudinal records in the EHR, trying to make sense of it and trying to move the needle from the point of view managing their chronic conditions. How has that worked so far? Any learnings that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, we're taking an approach that RPM has two really big buckets. This is almost oversimplified. The first bucket is to replicate what has happened for generations. When we walk into our provider's office, we get weight and core temperature and height and blood pressure and heart rate and all these sorts of things. So we can replicate that when the visit occurs via video by remote capture, just to continue to be able to capture the same sort of quality data that we have for generations. Perhaps more importantly, though, is when our providers are being asked to make clinical decisions based on a single data point or a very precious few data points over a long longitudinal time point, then I feel like we're under-informed in these decisions. So the way we're structuring it is we send patients home with whatever the appropriate biometric kit might be it blood pressure, glucose monitoring, or pulse oximeter, et cetera. Bring these data in to a repository or a lake short of our electronic health record, where we can analyze the data. We can apply rules to trigger alerts. These will be alerts to the provider team, to the care team, if there's either a series of or a sequence of progressively out of range numbers, or an alert or a value that's particularly high or low that's somewhat dangerous that we want to intervene with, or send alerts to patients. And these might be an alert to patient because we haven't received a value in a few days, or because the values are trending well and we want to send them a nudge that says, congratulations, good job. The work you're doing is being effective and your blood pressure is becoming under control. You've lost 5 pounds, whatever. Or the reverse. If the trends are actually going in the wrong direction, we want to send an encouraging message to help them to get back on course, to help them and the provider titrate medicines, to help them and the provider change some course in one way or another. And then, of course, the long game is once we capture enough of these data points across a broad enough segment of our population that's representative enough, then we'll be able to get smart about what normal recovery looks like after a procedure, about what normal or well looks like, about when a variant in the data is actually meaningful or when it's a predictable variant that's innocuous. And so we're blessed to have really, really tremendous data science people around here to be able to look at these big data sets and find the pearls in them. So we'll be able to work to set up predictive models to understand when data are indicating that action should really be taken. This also has, I think, a workflow utility, because we can then even tell patients in advance when we're comfortable with this modeling. You can expect something like this to occur on, you know, somewhere between day 4 and 6 after you've gotten home. I'm making up an example. Yeah. That's the journey we're on.
This podcast is brought to you with the support of our partners, Innovacer and Palbox.
This is obviously a great segue to my next question, which is going to be about data and analytics and how you're driving that. I imagine that RPM is just one of many use cases for data and analytics. But can you talk to us about how you're set up specifically as it relates to data and analytics to serve the multiple needs of the enterprise? You have a centralized data and analytics function, and you mentioned predictive models, artificial intelligence. That's, again, a term that you know everybody uses, and success rates have varied widely depending upon the use case, depending upon the institution. Could you give us a little bit of state of the union, or you know, just share a little bit of what successes you've had and how you're structured?
Sure, sure. I'll speak to this as a consumer of these really very brilliant people that I have the pleasure of working with. One of my peers is a chief analytics officer, and so he and his team are responsible for all the structure. I did mention the lake that's in place that, you know, I oversimplify it, and they would do a much better job of describing what we're doing there. But that lake, of course, is built in such a way for us to be able to pile in multiple data streams. So in the very near term future, we'll have an ability to inform our clinical decisions on things beyond just the very rich electronic health record data. There are tons of things in the electronic health record, but it's incomplete, of course. So in this lake, repository, we'll have RPM data, we'll have social determinant data. As data become more and more available on other social things, expense, spend, these sorts of things, we'll be able to put these data sets in there too. You would know as well or better than me that zip code is as powerful a predictor as medication list of certain outcomes clinically. And so we'll have these social drivers in there. I think we'll be able to put in geofencing and geolocation data as part of our remote monitoring journey. All of this, of course, with consent of patients. And if we do with these data as we should, then the patients become a great beneficiary of the work we're doing here.
Yeah, I'd love to go into that maybe in another podcast conversation. There's so much there to unpack and so much there to discuss emerging data sources and, you know, what's a better predictor versus something else and so on. But let me come back to, now you mentioned your role and it reports up into the CIO. I'm just curious, could you talk to us a little bit about the org model for driving digital transformation? How's it structured? You know, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. As I mentioned, I report into the CIO. I am not a deep technician. I'm not an engineer. I come at this from a clinical angle. I'm a clinician first and a strategist and a digital health person second. I have a team that's relatively small. We're responsible for our portal, as I mentioned. We have people with broad backgrounds. We have a nurse on our team. We have a physician who serves as our medical director. We have people trained specifically in clinical informatics. We have a couple of other physical therapists. So a broad and diverse team. We work very carefully and closely with operational colleagues in the health system, clinical and operational leads, to understand the opportunities that our clinicians are experiencing, to find what I would like to call clever use of technology to ease their workflow, to ease the ability for them to engage with the patients, to empower the patients with information and with tools to supplement their care in between clinical encounters. And so while I report in through and our budget is through our IT shop, we do nothing and would never try to do anything without our operational colleagues to actually be able to implement workflow, to be able to set appropriate impact metrics, to be able to have baseline data against which to compare. I call them impact metrics because it's not just about numbers of adoption of this tool or that. It's about, you know, what difference did we make? what does it matter that we have a million people on our portal account if in fact, you know, there's no impact of having a million people there except two commas in the number. And so we work extremely collaboratively on a daily basis with the clinical and ops leads who are at the tip of the spear.
Let's talk about the tech. You're obviously deeply engaged with the technology stack and the technology vendors who help you. How do you approach your technology choices for your transformation? For instance, you've got your electronic health record, which does a lot of things, but you've also got an enterprise-class CRM platform and maybe specialized tools for RPM and some of the other things that you talked about. And you have a choice. So you can go to the big tech firms. You could go at the other end to extremely small, nimble, and innovative startups and a whole range in between. How do you parse through those choices and how do you approach them, especially when it comes to the risks?
That's a question that, candidly, I wrestle with every single day.
I imagine.
We have invested mightily in our electronic health record, and that's mightily in dollars and effort. And I think we have a very mature installation of our enterprise electronic health record. However, it's a transactional system. It is the system of record. It houses our legal medical record, and it is responsible for the actual transactions. And that's important, and that's really critical, and we don't break that, right? We also work extremely hard because our clinicians of all stripes are very, very busy. And so we have a concept that I was taught by our prior CTO, who calls it it's a classic term, you know, single pane of glass. And so we have a fairly high bar before we'll ask our providers or our clinical staff or our administrative staff whose day is in the electronic health record. It's a fairly high bar for us to say, for this purpose, go to another application. And so when we want to bring in another application, we try very hard to allow us to be able to launch it from within the primary health record, the place where our staff are working all the time. We insist on single sign-on capabilities. We insist on being able to preserve contextual awareness. If I'm working with this patient in the health record and I launch application B, I should be able to find the same patient in application B without any effort to reduce errors and such. But it is, I would tell you that our pendulum swings all the time between high-level enterprise solutions and fit for purpose. And it's an eternal struggle. So all that to say is, I know I'm not answering your question clearly, but it is maybe the unanswerable one.
Yeah. When it comes to innovation and innovative technologies, now I know you have your own innovation group within the organization, within you. And then, of course, there's a lot of innovation that is happening right now in the market. There's billions and billions in venture capital money, for instance, going to innovative startups. Many of them have very interesting solutions, but sometimes it can be overwhelming to parse through all of that to find that little nugget. Or when you do find that nugget, for reasons beyond your control or their control, they might fail for a variety of reasons. So let's say I have a startup founder who comes to me and says, look, I want to talk to Matt. I have this really, really interesting solution, which I think is going to make his life and his patients' lives easier. How do I approach Matt and what is he looking for? What is the answer you would give to someone like that?
Yeah, with startups, I tend to say some of this advice is unwelcome to startups. One bit is, for a complex organization like ours, the sales cycle is longer than you, the startup, or I would like it to be. But it's just the reality. We work very hard to shorten it, but it's complex, and I'm not saying it's right, but the reality is it takes a long time. So be patient is one. Two is, I think that the point that we made a moment ago about respect the single pane of glass as much as possible is important. Even if that widget is just simply remarkable and game-changing, if we can't get it in front of the users, and I mean the busy clinicians, I also mean the patients, then it won't matter. Right. In other words, I don't know what the number is, but there is a tipping point where we can put too many applications on a patient's device, and then it becomes noise rather than signal. And then, you know, a patient who has comorbid conditions and we have three or four or whatever the number is, really magical applications that could stand to change that patient's course. If we can't elegantly get that patient to interact with that application, then it's somewhat meaningless. So patients, single pane of glass integration, which should be easier and easier as time passes because of FHIR standards and smart application capabilities and these sorts of things, and undersell and overdeliver, right? And by that, I mean, it's somewhat obvious. It's, if it's a niche product, it's a niche product. But the other side of that continuum is the large company or the medium-sized company who comes into an organization like this one and says, we can solve all your problems. That's somewhat of an oversell.
Yeah.
I would be suspicious.
Yeah. That's good advice. We're coming up to the end of our time here, and I have one last question for you, Matt. Based on your experience over the last few years that you've been in this role, and you've clearly seen a lot of progress, and you've had your share of successes, and I'm sure you've had your share of things that didn't go as you planned it to be. What's your one or two pieces of advice or best practices that you would like to share with your peers in the industry who are on similar transformation journeys?
Thank you. One, I love the question, and I would answer it by saying, be persistent, be tenacious, don't stop. I won't tell you that I have best practices because this is a personal semantic question for me. I don't like that term because it implies I already have what's best and it can't get better. And so to me, the answer is tenacity. Try something, carefully monitor the impact, make a change, try something again. I happen to think that's the key. Don't be afraid to try something new. Be obviously cautious and be obviously judicious in these changes because we're talking about patient safety. But where possible, the classic fail fast mentality to me is wise. And then once you've failed, then you change and learn and reapply.
But don't necessarily move fast and break things is the subtext. Yeah. Well, Matt, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you so much for sharing all of those insights. Once again, all the best with the upcoming Go Live. I know it's going to be a big one for you. And I look forward to following all of the work and the progress that you make. Once again, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Penny. Thank you for all you do. Appreciate you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can reach us at info@thebigunlock.com with your feedback and questions. This podcast is brought to you with the support of our partners, Innovacer and Palbox.